Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Cole and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Kowal. Both Jeff and I are certified appellate specialists, and as uncertified podcast hosts, we try to bring our audience of trial and appellate attorneys some legal news and perspectives they can use in their practice. If you find this podcast useful, please recommend it to a colleague.
Yeah, if you find it unhelpful, go ahead and send it to your opposing counsel.
All right, and Jeff, you challenged me to come up with a new opening gag, and I'm still working on it, but our audience will have to labor under my stale old gag for a little bit longer. This week, Jeff, I thought we'd just cover an interesting case on the Racial Justice Act. There was a divided opinion in People versus Orias Tegui out of the 2nd District, Division 6. This was the facts of the case were, you know, not all that exciting. It's a residential burglary case, and the defendant was found guilty. But on appeal, the divided panel reversed on the basis of the Racial Justice Act. So what happened is that under the Racial Justice Act, the reversal was not because the defendant was not guilty. And in fact, as Judge Presiding Justice Gilbert noted in his dissent, the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. But instead, what had happened is that the prosecution had made a peremptory challenge to one of the prospective jurors, and that prospective jurors was apparently or allegedly Hispanic or had a Hispanic surname. And so the defense said, no, that is presumptively invalid because it was for racial reasons. And the courts the court took argument on the point. Prosecution said no, it had nothing to do with race or because of the surname. It was because this prospective juror seemed had lacked life experiences, didn't have a job, didn't have any military experience, didn't have sufficient connections to the community. And the judge said, yeah, that passes muster with me. So objection overruled.
So, right. So let me pause you there. So at this point, the trial court had followed the traditional Batson-Wheeler process for evaluating whether peremptory challenges are being exercised in a neutral manner, right? Everything is just the way we learned it in law school, right?
Yeah, that's right. And but what happened under this case is that the Court of Appeal thought, no, there was, even though there was no actual bias, it didn't find that the prosecution actually was biased, and the majority went out of its way to note that it was not finding that the prosecutor was motivated by bias. And there was also no suggestion that had that challenged juror been left on the panel, that the outcome would have been different. And this gets to why I wanted to talk about this case, Jeff, is that there was no finding of prejudicial error. The majority panel decided that the objection should have been sustained, and that prospective juror should have been left on the jury panel. And for that reason alone, the guilty verdict was overturned without even any analysis under the miscarriage of justice standard. Under the California Constitution, a judgment may not be reversed unless there is a finding that the error caused a miscarriage of justice. So that's why I thought this case was very interesting, and Presiding Justice Gilbert mentioned this in his dissenting opinion. So the majority had reasoned that to overrule the objection, the trial judge must make a finding that the prosecution's asserted reasons for the challenge must bear on the juror's ability, this is the statutory language, the juror's ability to be fair and impartial in the case. And that's Code of Civil Procedure, Section 231.7, Subdivision F. But the trial court didn't make this express finding, and that required per se reversal because, as the court reasoned, it is imperative that trial courts heed Section 231.7's new mandates to root out discriminatory uses of peremptory challenges, end quote. And so all well and good for the cause of rooting out systemic injustice perceived or implicit bias. But in dissent, Presiding Justice Gilbert noted that even though he agreed with the purposes of the Racial Justice Act, the trial judge really did implicitly make that finding, even though it didn't use those express words. Yes, the express words from the statute, the same appellate procedures apply, and implied findings will be implied on appeal. unless there's no substantial evidence to support it. And the presiding Justice Gilbert said that the majority's decision to reverse was not logical because the trial court, just because the trial court did not deploy what Justice Gilbert called the talismanic phrase that I find by clear and convincing evidence, the reasons of the prosecutor for the peremptory challenge bear on this prospective juror's ability to be fair and impartial in this case. Justice Gilbert said, this is taking literalism into the realm of the absurd. But then Justice Gilbert goes on to talk about what I really wanted to talk about with you, Jeff, that he mentioned there is a cogent argument that had been raised by Justice Yeagan in his dissent back last year in People versus Simmons. And note, Jeff, that when he says that it's a cogent argument, that really is saying something, because Justice Yeagan was dissenting to presiding Justice Gilbert's majority opinion in the People versus Simmons case. So it makes one wonder, if Justice Gilbert thinks it was so cogent, why did he go against Justice Yeagan in authoring the majority opinion in the Simmons case? But getting to that cogent argument that Justice Yeagan raised, that Justice Gilbert is now relying on, he says that the Racial Justice Act violates the doctrine of separation of powers. And here we're going to get into the constitutional requirement that to reverse a judgment, the Court of Appeal has to make a finding of a miscarriage of justice. And that was actually affirmed in a case that we talk about that comes up frequently in our discussions, Jeff, FP versus Monier, which talked about statements of decision, which is a big recurring topic for us appellate attorneys. We always ask trial attorneys, make sure that you request a statement of decision and object. Because if you don't have one, and if you don't object, then it could be a good ground for reversal. It would have been a better ground for reversal if F.P. Monier went the other way. But what had happened in F.P. Monier is that the appellant had requested a statement of decision. The judge didn't make all the findings that were requested. And the appellant jumped up and down and said, aha, you've got to reverse now, because a statement of decision is required. Under Code of Civil Procedure, Section 632, the judge has to make all the findings on all the principal controverted issues, and the judge didn't do that. And that means you have to reverse. And the Supreme Court said, well, that's a good argument, but the Constitution still says that there has to be a finding of a miscarriage of justice. So, yes, you have established that there was an error, but now you have to persuade us that error resulted in a miscarriage of justice. And that's been the law at least since 2017, that even if there's a missing finding, even if there's a finding that that the legislature says, judge, you have to make this finding or else it's error, that is still subject to the constitutional requirement that error still has to be shown to be prejudicial, would have led to a different result had the judge complied with that statutory requirement. And what is different and what the Racial Justice Act does, Jeff, is that it has a provision that says that any violation of this act is a miscarriage of justice. The legislature finds and determines that these provisions are so important that any violation of them constitutes a structural error and thus a miscarriage of justice. And Justice Yeagan said this is a separation of powers problem. Addressing the fact that he reasoned that what constitutes a miscarriage of justice under the Constitution must be independently determined by the judiciary. That question cannot be usurped by another branch of government. So absent a finding that the particular violation of the Racial Justice Act resulted in a miscarriage of justice, the judgment must be affirmed even despite violations of the act. And Justice Yeagan had ended his dissent in the Simmons case by quoting Marbury versus Madison, saying that the legislature cannot dismantle California's separation of powers doctrine by dictating to the judiciary how the California Constitution should be construed. What do you think of that so far, Jeff? Do you find yourself in agreement with Justice Yeagan and Justice Gilbert? Or do you think that the Racial Justice Act and the legislature can decide, where its determination should be either dispositive or probative on the question of whether there is a structural error?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if the situation were the courts determining, either the California Supreme Court or a Court of Appeal determining we find that every violation of this statute is so bad in light of the legislative policy behind this statute that we're going to hold that it's structural error and always per se reversible, that would be one thing. But I tend to agree here that when the legislature is telling the court how it must so find in every case, there's a bit of blurring the lines in terms of separation of powers.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the way you just phrased it is that the legislature is making a determination, a legislative determination, meaning irrespective of the case, irrespective of the parties, of the facts of the case, of the circumstances, of the balancing of equities, that in every case, and that is a legislative determination by one branch of government. And the Constitution is meant to be, you know, they are co-equal branches of government, as we know, and the judicial power answers questions differently. It cannot answer questions for all cases, for all parties, for all time. It answers each question on the merits of each case. And so the exercise of judicial power requires the judiciary to answer that question in a different way. And just relying on a legislative determination, I think Justice Egan has a point that there is a separation of powers problem there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Now, another angle to this that I wanted to bring up, Jeff, is that this discussion called to mind another case that we had talked about, Abdel Kader. We talked about this case a couple of times. We talked about it when it came out in 2022, and it was one of our most important cases on this that we've discussed on this podcast. That was the case that held that under Family Code Section 3044, where there has been a prior finding of domestic violence, that prior finding triggers a presumption of unfitness for child custody. So when you come to cases involving child custody and the parents are trying to decide who gets custody, if one parent gets full custody, a parent who has a prior finding against him or her of domestic violence has a very high burden to overcome. And if the judge wants to grant that person custody, that judge has to make express findings of various statutory factors to satisfy the legislative requirement that this parent is fit to have custody of the child, despite the fact that this parent has a prior finding of domestic violence. And in Abdel Kader, the judge had awarded custody to the respondent who had a prior finding of domestic violence against him. And the appellant said, well, what gives? There's not been the express findings required by the legislature. So you have to reverse. You didn't meet the requirements of Family Code Section 3044 by making the express determinations. And the Court of Appeal agreed and said, yes, without these express findings, reversal is required. It's per se reversal. And that made me wonder, well, what the heck did the Supreme Court do in FP versus Monier when it said that the failure to make a required statement of decision finding was not per se reversible, but the failure to make a required Family Code 3044 finding is per se reversible. And interestingly, the Abdel Kader panel never even mentioned the FP Monier case. So it seems like, and it's a published case, it has been followed by another case, Hutchins, and distinguished by another case, Marriage of Berger. We'll cite all those in the show notes. We actually talked about these in an episode a couple of weeks ago, Jeff. It so happens that the attorney in Abdel Kader reached out to us, and we're going to have a conversation with him about his frustrations with the Abdel Kader case coming up soon here. What do you think about this, Jeff? That there are these different cases that some find that there is a requirement to make findings and it's per se reversible if the court fails to make the findings. In other cases that say, no, it's not per se reversible. You still have to show a miscarriage of justice.
Well, let me just say this. In family law custody disputes, they are so close. The evidence can be so compelling and so close that I think the trial courts really benefit from having presumptions imposed upon them by the legislature over, like, in a closed case, the tie goes this way or the other. It's helpful for the trial courts. And I think, unless I misheard you, I think you could harmonize these cases in that the case Abraham with the presumption is very different than the other cases involving statements of decisions without a presumption, that the presumption imposes certain obligations on the trial court to really make findings, as opposed to the generic, well, you should have a statement of decision. So perhaps that's the way you harmonize them, is the existence of a rebuttable presumption in the evidence code section bearing on what you do with presumptions in the absence of evidence, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a good point. The fact of a rebuttable presumption does affect the analysis, but I still don't think you get from there to per se reversal. I think you still have to look at substantial evidence to see if there is substantial evidence to rebut that presumption. It makes it more difficult if you don't have those findings. So I just still don't think you get to per se reversible error. But yeah, you're definitely right that the presumptions do affect the analysis. And I wonder if you get to something like remember there used to be a debate whether when the standard of proof in the trial court was clear and convincing evidence, that standard melted away when you got to appeal, and it was the same old substantial evidence that applies to everything else until you had conservatorship of OB that said, right, no, you still have to factor in the clear and convincing evidence standard even when you're doing substantial evidence review.
Yeah, maybe this Abraham case needed to make a clear and explicit finding that the rebuttable presumption made this case distinguishable from the other cases.
Yeah. One other case to throw into the mix here for the similar point is Marriage of Steiner. This was a 2004 case, but this comes up if you're in a you're in a property division suit. So we're still in the family law context, Jeff. So if the parties are trying to divide their assets, they have to make financial disclosures so that you know what each side has got and what their income is. And that is so important to the determination of a property division that the legislature has declared that under Family Code 2107D, that if disclosures are inadequate or untimely, that defect is reversible per se. So here we're coming full circle back to the Racial Justice Act issue, where the legislature is dictating to the courts, this error is always a miscarriage of justice. And so specifically, Family Code 2107D says, if a court enters a judgment when the parties have failed to comply with all the disclosure requirements of this chapter, the court shall set aside the judgment. The failure to comply with the disclosure requirements does not constitute harmless error. Or to put that in the affirmative, that error is a miscarriage of justice. It's prejudicial error. And again, when it says shall set aside the judgment, that's directly contrary to the Constitution that says the court shall not set aside a judgment unless there's a finding of miscarriage of justice.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Marriage of Steiner case went on to say that no, that the legislature doesn't get to sidestep that. It cited Article 6, Section 13 of the Constitution that we've been talking about, requiring a finding of miscarriage of justice, and to the degree that Family Code 2107 is read for the proposition that a judgment must be set aside or a new trial granted solely because of a failure to exchange final declarations of disclosure, it is not consistent with our state's constitution. Consequently, the failure to provide the final disclosure required by Section 2105 does not constitute a get a new trial free card.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I wonder, you know, the case involving the Racial Justice Act is relatively new, came out in early April. I wonder if there'll be any requests out there to either depublish it or supporting. I wonder if there'll be some amicus briefs supporting California Supreme Court taking review of the case.
Yeah. I think it's likely that it may be taken up on review. Justice Yeagan had pointed out that in that case, the Simmons case, apparently there was not a dispute about the final outcome, so no party filed a petition for review, but that doesn't seem to be the case in the Oreostegui case, and so we may be looking out to see if a party files a petition for review, and it'll be curious to see whether the Supreme Court decides to take it up, or maybe because you say, Jeff, it is a new statute. Maybe it'll wait for more opinions to percolate before deciding to take it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So any upshots that you take away from these cases, Jeff, where we talked about, we have the family code disclosure requirements that say, where the legislature has determined that this is per se reversible error, and the courts have said, nah, you don't get to do that. And then the Racial Justice Act that has done, you know, apparently said the same thing, and the courts so far have gone along with it.
Yeah, you know, I guess if you're embedded appellate counsel, or if whispering in the ear of trial counsel, or if you're a trial counsel and you're doing jury selection, and the trial court has not made an explicit finding using the magic words from the statute, you might have a pocket brief ready to go to suggest that the court actually use those magic words on the record, not in chambers, to ensure that your final outcome is final.
Yeah. Yeah. That's important. Justice Gilbert did chide the majority in the Oreostegui case for requiring that litigants requiring that the trial courts use the talismanic phrase from the statute. Well, the nice thing though about the majority opinion is that at least there is a talismanic phrase. There is an easy way to make sure that you're in compliance with the Racial Justice Act, and you just cite cite that statute and move right along.
Make a laminated card of that language and pass it out to trial judges start of jury selection.
Is there a way, if your trial judge is not familiar with the Oreostegui case, is there a way to signal to the judge, Your Honor, thank you for overruling, if you're the prosecution, thank you for overruling the objection, but could you overrule it this way and say these words?
Yeah, I mean, that's why God invented pocket briefs, so you could attach new case law to it and help educate and bring trial judges up to speed.
But does it make it sound like it's ad hoc? That, well, I didn't really make that finding, but if I have to make that finding, I'm going to do it. Is there a way to pre-educate the judge about the requirement?
I don't know. You could foresee these kinds of challenges coming up, but I don't know that if you are educating the judge in the moment, that would make the decision any more susceptible to reversal on appeal.
Yeah. All right, Jeff. Well, we're just going in and out with this case today. We'll come back next week with some more cases and tidbits and advice for trial and appellate attorneys. If you have suggestions for future episodes, please email us at info@calpodcast.com. And in our upcoming episodes, look for more tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again